Good morning. It's getting very close now.
Have you done your own shop yet?
Oh, you know what, Sarah? I have to say, I think my pet peeve at this time of year is what you've just done there, where people go, "Are you all set? Are you all set?" No, of course not. If you're all set, you're doing it wrong, frankly.
In which case, we're doing it all perfectly correct here. Fiona Looney with Sarah on Drive Time. Oh, enough of that. More on that seasonal evil later. But let's see if you can guess this artist. Oh, the fun and games beginning already.
On selected press criticism of me, over the years, I have been described by critics as narrow-minded, manipulative, sinister, perverse, fraudulent, conspiratorial, totalitarian, evil, a card-carrying hatchet man, the calculating Trotsky of British contemporary art, a darling of the Sirota tendency, the Gauleiter of Goldsmiths, the Panjundrum of British art, a pop artist, a minimalist, a conceptualist, a minimalist conceptualist, not a household name, a man with no style, deserving only derision, better known as a teacher than an artist, an Irish artist, an American artist, a British artist, the celebrated Anglo-Irish-American artist, a failed artist, number 608 out of 612 in the Tatler list of people who really matter, the most hated man in British art.
The answer, Michael Craig Martin, actually one of the most influential visual artists of his generation. And on Sunday Evening Just Gone, a portrait of the artist from Cliona ni Aon Lún. But let's keep it festive with more scathing, sarcastic and downright mean descriptions. This is Matt Cracht, author of The Field Guide to Dumb Birds of North America. And this book was recommended as the ideal Christmas present on Mooney Goes Wild. Ornithological humour. Raise your eyebrows. Here's the author himself. And first up, the Eastern Kingbird.
This big-headed dope looks like he's wearing a business suit. A medium-sized songbird of eastern North America, this kingbird is notable for his stiff, upright posture of self-importance common to many business types. And then I give an identification tip here. Dark gray upper parts, crisp white throat, chest, and abdomen, with just a bit of cuff showing at the tail. Probably heavy starch. He thinks he's better than you.
Charming. Then the Western Meadowlark.
Look at this jerk singing his heart out. The Western Meadowlark is a medium-sized, iditarod bird, whatever that means. It builds its nest on the ground in open grasslands, which proves it's stupid. If you can fly, then why the hell don't you just build your nest in a tree where it's at least safe from dogs? Plus, it's the state bird of like six states you wouldn't want to live in.
But it was for the Canada goose that he saved his most withering words.
Thanks a lot, Canada. These f***ers are often considered a pest species. Why? Because of their depredation of crops, their noise, droppings, aggressive behavior, and habit of begging for food in urban parks, not to mention that incessant honking and their long, stupid necks. Basically, everything about these geese just makes you want to choke them.
When good twitchers go bad. With Oliver, Emmett Kirwan. He's touring his play.
These dot stems and those.
It's all about accents.
The fact of the matter is that all people with all accents, even in this country, so many are mangling the English language, you know. So, yeah. Like, South County Dublin would put SH sounds on T sounds, like favourite.
Yeah, it gets but very soft.
It's favourite.
It's nice.
Yeah, but if we were to all speak phonetically and correctly and precisely and crisply, we'd all kind of sound a little silly. Because it'd be a kind of forced formality, you know.
Yeah.
It's like a Dublin accent, for example, you know, working class Dublin accent would replace the T with a glottal. So you might say matter, and then a middle class one might tap the two T's and turn it into matter, and then a very posh accent might say matter. But all three are wrong.
Nobody's like matter.
Nobody's
that
saying matter.
Weird.
Yeah, it sounds strange.
What's
so what
matter?
Yeah. So the idea of somebody from Ireland correcting another person or saying speak correctly, they're usually probably not speaking correctly.
We drop that middle T like all over the country,
all
don't
over
we?
This,
like
yeah.
Be Wahar.
Wahar.
And Manan and Tipperary would be Saturday.
Yeah.
Just disappears.
Just goes all together.
Saturday.
Yeah. Saturday. Yeah. It just sounds silly, you know.
And you wouldn't want that. But if you do want to sound clever, here's some linguistics.
All Irish accents are rhotic, so we pronounce our R's. Welsh and Scottish accents are rhotic, so we pronounce both R's in the word. So if an R precedes a vowel sound, you pronounce it like ro. And if R follows a vowel sound in a rhotic accent, we pronounce it. But in a non-rhotic accent, which is closer to London, you drop the R sound. So Rover becomes Rover. You know, and then Belfast accent's heavily rhotic. It's where they pronounce all their R's in it.
Jump it back to them.
And of course, how you sound changes depending on the context.
What happens is your accent is actually whatever comes out of your mouth when you're angry or when you're... That's the true accent.
True you.
And what you sound like when you're speaking to your friend group that you grew up with. So that's your true accent. And when you go into the workspace, you might find yourself changing it, putting on your phone voice as an expression, you know. So, you know, and even now I'm speaking slowly in order to be understood. I'm doing it right now.
Naturally be very conscious of your accent.
Just conscious, yeah, and as well.
But you've kept, your accent has never changed, I'd imagine.
I think I've tried to maintain it. I've made a concerted effort to try and maintain it. But I think even when I go home, the Tala accent is a little bit more nasal, kind of goes up here and it's a little, so we kind of talk to God, must you let me brother have this kind of accent, you know? And so I find myself even dropping down slightly an octave when I'm on radio.
Because my Monaghan accent has now been well worn out.
But you could
the odd vowel, here and there. And obviously you go home, it's completely different depending who you're talking to.
And all of a sudden then you revert back because you're using less English as well. You don't need to use as much language in order to be understood by your family or your peer group.
Okay, because the language has been set.
You have a shorthand.
You know? Looked at it that way.
Yeah.
Because you can't introduce new words.
I
discovered when I was about 7 and started saying superb.
I know, I used the word malice one time in Tala and someone looked at me and said, "You've changed, man." And there was no irony in that. He was deadly serious. I'd gone to college and I said, "Don't think there's any malice in the fella." And he said, "What? Who are you?" Yeah. Frankenstein.
Stop talking like a novel.
Yeah, yeah.
And even here at the National Broadcaster, he might still be keeping us on the straight and narrow.
There's probably someone hidden in a basement downstairs, like a Brian Dobson 101, you know, that everybody is copying what they say.
So newsreaders think they're in their own little microcosm.
I think it is. And it's obviously influenced by where they're from and their own voice. Mm. But then they come into the field and think, this is the way I have to sound, so I need to copy this particular enunciation and pronunciation.
Look, I think it's not that long ago they hung a dinner jacket at the back of the door in a studio for newsreaders so that you would have this suddenly sit up differently and
treat
the script. Yeah,
clothes make the man. Yeah.
Black tie and ball gowns, baby. Always. And with Miriam, a man in serious danger of becoming a national treasure. Tommy Tiernan. This was the opening question.
Great. I'm just thinking you look really rested.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't feel it. I'm in a permanent state of pressure. I'm a buzz hunter. I need stimulation, so I lurch from caffeine to collapse. That would be the state of my life, really. I get up in the morning, I have a double espresso, then I meditate for half an hour. So you got the two extremes there already. Then I might have a cigar at 9:30. And I'll try and come up with some ideas for stand-up. And then I might have a snooze and then more coffee and then sugar. So I'm on a fairly active elastic band of tension and release all day.
And he likes to move. Mad for road.
I love it. I love driving around Ireland. The momentum of it and the ever-changing scenery and to have the moral courage to pull off the motorway and drive the old road from Galway to Dublin. And it does take moral courage because you opt out of the rat race because people say, I'll be there in an hour and a half, 2 hours. But you go the old road and it's four and a half. Longer if you pull into Tyrrell's Pass for sandwiches. There's great slow winding roads. And if your car has hips, you just you swing from ditch to ditch. It's delicious.
And it was an interview in which he talked about his family, his love for his father and his difficult relationship with his late mother, Helen. He also talked about when he met his wife, Yvonne. And this is what he did just after meeting her for the very first time.
She was walking on before him, her hands holding her skirts up from the slush. Got that tattoo, I would say, about 25 seconds after I met my wife. Not literally, but in, that's when I met her, I it was kind of like being on ecstasy or something. I've never felt so upside down and loved and high. There's a great phrase in Irish, "fui yasa," under a spell, you know. And I definitely I fell tremendously, catastrophically, dangerously in love. And it was it felt like to say it was you're in love with somebody kind of sounds like it was you're doing it, the experience a disservice. But I was very vulnerable to it, I suppose, in a way, because I never had that. My mother and I really were we were associates rather than lovers, if that makes sense, you know. I think when I met Yvonne, something, I don't know, it was like a part, it's like a chakra that had never opened in me. Opened or something that I wasn't able to control.
That is romantic. Now he's touring, he loves it. He prepares meticulously, but when he gets on stage, it all goes out the window.
In the moment, it's high. In the moment, it's wild. You're the boldest brat that ever spoke, and you're saying, "What? Oh God, stop!" And you're filled with that kind of stage bravado, and the you're not afraid of anything, and phrases and sentences are flowing through you, and you'll say the thing that nobody, no, and it's out your mouth and people are laughing and they're delighted that they're there to hear it and not to take responsibility for it, and then they're drinking and they're walking home, and then you're on your own going, who would say those things? Do you know? So I find that's the part of stand-up that I find difficult.
Tommy Tiernan with Miriam. Now, did you see them? No, not stars, but the Geminid meteor shower. Frances McCarthy of Blackrock Castle Observatory joined Carol on the News at One.
First of all, can you just tell us what is a meteor shower and what does it look like?
Well, the shooting stars that children love to see. Oh, make a wish, there's a shooting star. Those are properly known as meteors. They're small pieces of space debris that are in the Earth's orbit, and at certain times of the year, in a predictable fashion, as we move around the sun, we move into this debris cloud and it burns up in our atmosphere. So they're shooting across the sky. They're not stars. They're just little bits, in this case, of an asteroid that orbits the sun. It passes past the Earth, leaving bits of it behind.
Putting us straight on our astronomy. Got it. Now, we are not above a little bit of a cheap titter here on Playback. And with the Darcy, a celebration of the markets on Mary Street and Henry Street, 75 years in business. Trader Kathleen spoke to Ray about the opposition.
And I'll give you a bit of laugh, right?
Right.
A few years ago, this is funny, a few years ago, they came up and asked, would we do an interview with Pat Kenny?
Right.
Same as we're doing with you now.
Yeah, yeah.
So no problem. So anyway, Pat came on and he said, "There you are, Kathleen, how's things?" So I grand. He said, "But can you tell me," he said, "what's the in thing this year?"
Right.
So I, "Well, Pat, they're all going mad for blue balls."
Right.
"Is he blue balls?" So yeah. "So have you got your blue balls?" "Sizzy, I don't know, I'll have to see." "So, well, if you come down to Henry Street and stand here for the day, your balls, you'll have blue balls." And he was in stitches. And you know, Pat doesn't laugh very easily now. But he was in stitches.
Oh, that's great. Brilliant. I love
right.
when I meet Pat Kenny, I'll tell him to go down to you. Good luck, see you. Bye.
Tell him about his blue balls.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Storm Dara really did rage last weekend, and the reverberations from that storm are still being felt. The damage at Holyhead Port, for one, and a backlog of goods and parcels stuck. On the News at One yesterday, Carol Coleman spoke to Simon McKeever from the Irish Exporters Association.
Do you know if there are backlogs at the port? We heard one story of up to 200 trucks waiting at the port, unable to move.
So yesterday, certainly there was stories of a 4 kilometre tailback in the port of Holyhead, and two of our members alone in the logistics community, one of them had 85 trailers stuck in the port, and another had 95 trailers stuck in the port. And that's just two of the out of two of ours alone. And Carol, the other thing, just to say to you that you know we're looking at this. You know, in terms of items coming into Ireland, and it's effective across all sectors. It is effective, obviously. It is going to affect consumer goods as well. But, you know, it also affects the export industry out of Ireland as well, because those very same trailers are used to get items off the island of Ireland on the return journey. And right now, you know, there is a considerable amount of foodstuffs waiting in warehouses to be shipped out into the UK. And you know, that is really, really important. And you heard Tom talking about that a minute ago. It's really important. This is not just an important issue to Ireland. It's a very, very important issue to both Wales and the UK as a whole, because those items need to get into the shops and on the shelves before Christmas. So it is an issue that is important to both countries.
And Storm Dara also left thousands of homes without power for quite a bit of the week. And in Leitrim, some houses are still waiting. Yesterday, Clare spoke to Leitrim Sinn Féin councillor Brendan Barry.
In South Leitrim, even still this morning, almost 7 days after the storm, there's several hundred people still without power and many others still waiting to get water supplies resumed. I suppose the ESB, in fairness to them, have drafted in additional crews today and every day all week. More and more crews have been coming from every county in Ireland and indeed France to try and help and restore people as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. But I suppose there's absolute carnage, I suppose is the word, with so many forestries and timber blown down and ESB lines totally destroyed. The total forest is down on top of the lines, and it's so bad that the ESB had to hire in timber harvesters, which is big machines for cutting down whole forests, and brought them into several forestries there to try and clear all the timber. There is so much of it on the ground.
And work continuing there to get the electricity restored. And on Monday, more trees down, this time at the National Botanic Gardens in Kilmacurra in County Wicklow. Over 120 trees, in fact. And one tree in particular was quite the loss. Gardener Seamus O'Brien spoke to Colm.
Our saddest loss was a great silver fir that grew beneath the drawing room of Kilmacurra House. It came as a gift from Avondale in 1790. So at that time, Avondale was owned by Charles Stuart Parnell's ancestor, Samuel Hayes, who was a speaker in the old Irish House of Parliament, but a great tree planter. So the Acton family recorded that the same tree came in a dig, a little two-wheel carriage from Avondale. It was planted just beneath the drawing room. It was hit in the early 19th century by the night of the Great Storm. It wrecked its head, but Storm Dara completely finished off the tree. So we have two different crews of tree surgeons in at the moment.
Right.
So
this is the night Ian na Gaoithe Mhóra that would people they, when people couldn't remember what age they were asked if they remembered it from 1839 so that they could
That's
be aged. And it survived that.
And it survived that. That was such a powerful storm that, for example, on our sister garden at Glasnevin in Dublin, which Glasnevin at the time is just a little village, but the only house that was safe to stay in that night was the director's house in the Botanic Gardens. All the other houses had thatched roofs and chimney stacks blew in on top of the thatch and set something like a quarter of all thatched cottages right. in Ireland on fire.
It was a tough scene to survey then. I mean, when you lose a tree like that, which must be one of the kind of signature pieces to show in the gardens, it's a tough day for all of you working there.
It's an enormous hit for a garden like this, because it's not just the rarity of those specimens, it's the age. You know, it's like losing an old member of your family. You get very close to these old trees, and They've seen so much history. You know, that old silver fir, it was a sapling 8 years before the 1798 rebellion. It's a very historic tree. But we will get on with it. We'll clean up, we'll replant, we'll make it better again. There's been a history of horticulture at Kilmacurra since the 7th century, you know, and it's seen lots of storms over the ages. So we'll replant and we'll fix it and make it better.
Seamus O'Brien of the National Botanic Gardens. And on Sunday, in Syria, after decades of rule by a vicious regime, the end of Bashar al-Assad's dictatorship. On This Week, Justin McCarthy brought us this.
The Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad has been overthrown, bringing a stunning end to his family's 50-year reign. It followed a rapid and surprising offensive by Islamist rebels led by the group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the largest and most organised of several rebel groupings in Syria. It's understood that a plane carrying Bashar al-Assad left Damascus this morning. It's not known where he went. In Damascus, the sound of gunshots rang out in celebration as rebel forces overthrew the government.
And on Monday's Morning Ireland, Audrey asked this of Borazu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent.
Will you tell us about the rebels who led this offensive, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS? Who are they?
That was the main component of the coalition of rebel groups that led this lightning offensive. They are a very Islamic radical group, basically former al-Qaeda linked, though they have cut their ties to al-Qaeda. The leader goes by the name of al-Jolani, as his nom de guerre, is a former fighter against the U.S. occupation in Iraq and a veteran of U.S. prisons in Iraq. But also, in some respects, over the last few years, shown a bit of pragmatism in their management of affairs in Idlib province, where they have been in power. In this sort of statelet they've carved out in northwestern Syria. So, it's a mixed bag. But one thing that I will say is that they are very, very Islamic fundamentalist.
So, Borzu, what might happen next? Are they supportive of a parliamentary democracy? Will there be multi-party elections, do you imagine, now in Syria?
I can't see the HTS that I know agreeing to multi-party elections. I have not, having spent time with this group in northwest Syria, having spoken to both their proponents and opponents, there doesn't seem to be any tendency towards a pluralistic political openness on the part of this organization. But who knows? Maybe events and history could reshape their point of view.
And on Tuesday's News at One, the BBC's Yogita Lamai brought us these voices from the central square in Damascus.
We are so happy here. We need Syria without Assad family, without Bashar al-Assad. We hope a good future.
What's your name?
My name is Abdul Qadir.
And how you're a student?
Yes, I'm a student.
And how do you feel today?
Free. It's the feeling of free. It's very amazing.
Freedom, freedom.
Because the people who take the decision, not anyone like Bashar al-Assad.
And what do you think is going to happen next year?
I don't know, this is for the new government, but I think everything will be better.
Well, one consequence of the regime's collapse was the opening of the prisons in Syria, prisons that were shocking in their brutality. On Drive Time, Cormac spoke to journalist Sally Hayden about Sidnaya prison.
I was there yesterday, and again, so a lot of people, as soon as they found out that Assad had fallen, they headed for Sidnaya because it's the most probably notorious prison where people were locked up, packed into cells, starved, executed. Amnesty International documented or issued a report that said that thousands of executions took place in the years after the Syrian revolution in 2011. There were people just heading there trying to find out information about their missing family members. I spoke to people who were missing, their mother, their sisters. One woman, she said she was missing her 16-year-old son. He had disappeared in 2013 and she was still hoping to find either him alive or any trace of him. I think that hope is turning to despair when a lot of people realize maybe they'll never get the answers that they were hoping to get. Sidnaya, yeah, it's very difficult to explain how horrific it is. Like, we saw, you know, ropes on the wall that were said to be used for execution. We saw this kind of crushing machine that apparently was a torture machine. And people were just like hunting. They're like knocking down the walls. They're hunting in every tunnel, every, you know, manhole, because they're searching for hidden chambers in the hope that they could find those missing people.
From Syria, Sally Hayden on Drive Time. Here at home, trouble for one newly elected TD, one-time Social Democrat Owen Hayes. We say one time because he was suspended from the Sock Dems and will now sit as an independent. This comes after Hayes confirmed that he sold his shares in software company Palantir for just under €200,000. 1 month after he was elected to Dublin City Council, not before, as he had previously stated. And Palantir is a company which supplies artificial intelligence tools to the Israeli military. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Professor of Politics at DCU Gary Murphy joined Gavin.
What do you make of all this?
I've been watching politics a long time, Gavin, and I've never seen anything quite like this, where a person has been suspended from his, in this case, political party before the Dáil has even sat. It's beyond parallel as far as I can recall. And it's a fiasco for the Social Democrats. It puts them in a very difficult position. They campaign very strongly on the grounds of their opposition to the Israeli war in Gaza and their support of the Occupied Territories Bill. Also, ethics in politics has been a big issue for the Social Democrats, and the mistyping of the form. We might give Deputy Hayes the benefit of the doubt in that. But any time you're saying or issuing a statement saying what I said earlier on was not true is a very bad day in politics, particularly in a scenario where the party has made a big deal of its virtue in relation to ethics and politics. So all one can say is that it's been an absolute fiasco for the Social Democrats.
We will leave that there and turn instead to Arena.
The crispness of a winter landscape is hard to beat. A sheen to that low winter sun, strikingly beautiful in my mind if you're out and about and able to enjoy it. We thought we would mark this particular time of year with a selection of wintry poetry as chosen by poet Enda Wiley, who is with me in studio this evening. And there is something about winter that has a sensibility of poetry about it.
Oh, definitely, most definitely. And I have to praise you on your lyrical introduction there.
Oh, yes. weeks of writing went into that.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful to be here and to be surrounded by winter poems. You're right, it is a dark season, but it's a great time for poets.
Glad someone's enjoying the darker evenings. But Enda Wiley did bring us this beauty of a poem.
And this is a translation from Derek Mann.
It is indeed. And I just love the idea as well that it's anonymous. The mystery of the anonymous poet. You know, there's been a long tradition of it.
17th century anonymous as well.
This is, yeah, indeed. And also there's drink in it, there's love in it, and there's also Slow Blossom, which is really beautiful. It's a tiny little poem, and I just think it packs a punch. And Derek Mann himself said that he was drawn to the idle intensity of doodles when he was doing these translations. They're from a book called Adaptations. Gallery Press brought them out in 2006. But I think really there he's being a bit humble, because they're beautiful, his translations. This is sparse, it's fine, it's really beautiful. So I'm going to give you this poem now called Folk Song from the 17th century, Irish Anonymous, translated by Derek Mahan. 100 men imagine love when I drink wine, and then I begin to think of your words and mine. The hills are silent now under a white rush of snow, and my love like slow blossom on a blackthorn bush.
Thank you.
every year. Beautiful. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, presents. Socks, socks, more socks. You can't go wrong with socks. Or maybe slippers. Shake it up. Or you could go for a little bit of crypto. Value may go up as well as down, as well as up again. Adam Maguire of the Business Desk gave the skinny to Anya Kerr in for Clare. Oh, and Bitcoin? Now it's all about meme coins.
So Dogecoins, crypto, is that also, given their rise in popularity, why we're seeing increased interest then in these so-called meme coins?
Yeah, there's kind of a rising tide happening across the industry. It's obviously not just Bitcoin that's benefiting. Other established coins like Ethereum and Litecoin have been doing quite well in recent weeks. And we've seen these meme coins as well. They're essentially kind of crypto denominations that are named after popular memes, which kind of helps them to stand out a bit. It maybe allows people to buy in as a bit of a, you know, they're showing they're in on the joke. Dogecoin would probably be the earliest example of a meme coin. It's been around since 2013. Recently, though, we've had a lot of new entrants. We've had Peanut, which is named after the squirrel that became the social media sensation. He was seized and then put down by New York health officials, which led to him becoming a kind of martyr for the online American right in the lead up to the election. He now has a coin named after him. There's Mudeng, which is a pygmy hippo that's become a popular joke online. And a dog with hat, which is based around a picture of a dog with a hat. And these are all coins that people are buying and selling. And they seem a little bit silly, and they are in a way, but they do kind of represent an interesting shift in how financial markets are now working, because they revolve around someone creating these and essentially trying to make them go viral. They're not actually saying there's any fundamental value behind them or there's a reason why you should invest in them. You know, people are buying them. They're not listening to financial experts. They're not really using, you know, what you might call logical financial decision making. They're kind of just following strangers online and they're buying it in for a bit of a laugh, really. And that's their motivation for doing so.
Your head would melt. With Oliver, actor and playwright Pat Kinnavan, the Cove man whose voice was almost as lovely as he seemed himself. And his plays, big themes, but one word titles.
With Forgotten, I wanted to talk about the challenges in Ireland of growing old and the challenges that are still here. Silent, the challenges of homelessness and how we deal with that and how we see that and how we balance our sense of consciousness about that. Underneath is about looking different in Ireland, not fitting into a mould. Before, the fourth piece is about parental alienation, particularly fathers kept away unfairly from their children. And recently then King is the final piece, and that's about mental health in Ireland and particularly men's mental health and isolation. So these are things that I was sad about, Oliver, but also furious sometimes about, and the only way I could express it was to put it into my work.
And what a body of work it is. And he talked to Oliver about good fortune and also getting older.
I see my kind of ancestors in my face or something like that.
Right.
I see a kind of a timelessness in my face as I get older. I don't mind it. I never really traded on... See, I'm not Timothy Chalamet. I never really traded on my looks. So yeah. So I don't care about
makes
that.
Makes a difference.
But I sometimes I feel as if I'm looking at my great-great-grandfather or something like that.
Wow.
It's really weird. Yeah.
You seem to have this kind of disposition that means whatever challenge comes along, you're going to sit with it and take it as an opportunity, whether it's bereavement.
Yeah, I'm not going to freak out. You know what I mean? It's like, I think, you know, you mentioned the homeless thing later on. I'm so lucky, you know, we all are. And coming up to this time of year, it's, I suppose it's a time really where I constantly count my blessings, you know. And life is hard, so buy a helmet, you know what I mean? I kind of go, that's it, you know, I'm so lucky, we're so fortunate at this part of the world. Talking to that man from Sudan this morning, like, he's telling me all his family are still there and he hasn't seen them in 5 years, you know.
Go ahead.
So it all comes round, doesn't it?
And he spoke about winning an Olivier Award, meeting Judi Dench, well, almost meeting Judi Dench, and Aikino, because what happens when you play Roy Keane, and then Roy Keane is in the theatre.
There was one night in the Olympia, I'll never forget it all, the lads were acting very strange, because we were very close, all of us, you know, it was mostly men in the cast, and we were very close. I noticed their body language was all really weird backstage. They were avoiding my eyes, and then it turned out that Roy was in the box in the Olympia,
oh my
but they,
God.
They didn't want to tell me in case it would freak me out. But he came backstage afterwards and he was a sweetheart. He was a lovely, lovely person. I've never really met somebody as charismatic as him.
Is that right?
Extraordinary presence, yeah. And he was really polite to everybody. I remember I kept having to wipe my hand off my costume because the sweat was pouring out through my palm before I shook hands with him. Like, it was just like I was pouring sweat yeah. out of my hand. And I didn't want to give him a creepy handshake, do you know what I mean?
Yes,
freak
him
out.
See, yeah.
So,
and the more you thought about it, the
yeah,
more
and
sweat
afterwards,
came.
Then I went into kind of PTSD. Like, I was like, oh my God, I just met Ricky. You know, because you don't get to meet Hamlet, you know what I mean? You don't get to meet Christy Mann from the Playboy of the Western World, do you know what I mean? It's the first time we actually got to meet the real person, you know? Yeah. But he had the most extraordinary connection with his eyes to people. Like, amazing. He'd give you his full attention. And anyway, he's a big hero in Cork and always will be. You know?
One rebel to another. You're yeah. always going to get a friendly stare. Mm. If there's such a thing.
Pat Kinnevan with Oliver. Now, Roy Keane, born in August, we checked. Bear with me. Because if you are with child, this festive period, due date looming, you might feel you've a lot on your plate, but we say, think of the children. Specifically, think of the elite athletes. Here is December baby Nick Greggs. He's just won silver in the under-23s in the European Cross Country Championships, a winner, yes. But as he told Darren Frehel, only by adopting a boy named Sue approach.
Being the end of December, it's just so, so annoying. Like, I was actually due to be born in January, but I was 3 weeks premature. So if I was, I would still be under 20. And then I would be in January, which everyone knows is kind of the perfect age range for athletics specifically. So, yeah, I think it does kind of make you just have to compete against guys who might be a year older. So it's not a bad thing. It kind of pushes you on to that next level. So you kind of have to just take the positives from it, like,
keep them in. Think of the podium. Now, are you single, ready to mingle, highball in one hand and a glint in your eye? Well, assuming it's not the 1950s, what do you do if you are a young woman, newly single at the end of your 20s? How do you date again? Aidan O'Connell told Ray all about it. Because you see, she's from Kerry, and when you date in Kerry, you commit.
But we always say there's nothing casual about dating in the country.
There's nothing
casual
about dating,
in the country. Right. Like, you meet someone, that first date, that's it.
Like, so already you're looking at that person as, yeah. What like, do we look like in a suit?
Yeah, like, buy the hat. Like, yeah. That, done.
So, nothing for it but to move up to the big smoke.
Like, I was raring to go. Like, I was like, Dublin, watch out. I moved back up to Dublin from Kerry, kind of upended my life in a lot of ways. I just had this image, it's going to be Sex in the City, it's yes. going to be amazing. And then the last one, last one bites the dust, one of my closest friends got into a relationship when I just moved up.
All right.
And then I was hit with this bombshell that I was the last single friend out of the immediate friend group. And then
she decided to dip her toe into the dating world and told Ray about the importance of timing.
Lads aged between 25 and 29, mad to settle down. Like, really would marry you, I would say, tomorrow.
Right.
But then when they turn 30, so when a woman turns 30, which I think is a lot of my, maybe why I was so upset initially, was because I was edging towards this big decade. And when you turn 30,
it's a big age.
It's a big age.
Why so?
Your biological clock starts to tick. Yes. You're starting to think, in a lot of ways, your world can kind of constrict a little bit as a woman because you are... Even though you have time, it doesn't really feel like it. And people around you are saying things. And
like what?
Friends, you know, like I had someone say to me, you'd really want to be thinking about having babies in the next like 2-3
years.
Did
they say it like that? You would want to be thinking about having babies.
They were like, you know, don't leave it like too
yeah.
late.
Yeah. That sort of conspiratorial whisper. That's
yeah,
it, yeah.
And I was like, okay, right. I was like, hadn't thought about that. But then for a man, now men can correct me here, but once they turned 30, it's like they realise they have 9 lives. And then they're like, oh, like I could actually, if I wanted to, I could have a baby when I'm in my 60s.
Yes.
You know.
You don't want
and
to
this
be doing
was
that,
confirmed
though.
To me by a man at the weekend. I was talking to him about it. And he's like, I actually had that thought. He was like, will I settle down? And then he goes, do you know what? No. I could still keep going.
Do you think?
So for now, at least, you can stand down at the mistletoe.
Date yourself. Date yourself.
You're actually good crack and you're really hot.
And here's the thing. And here's the thing. Even if you're in a relationship, it's not, you're not being unfaithful to your partner.
No, you that's the thing. Yeah. Exactly.
Yes, yes. So it's universal. It's universal.
Slightly confusing, but it might work. That was Aidan O'Connell with Ray. And we started the programme with this question.
Are you all set?
Ooh, and if you are doing the food shopping anytime soon, steering that trolley, elbows out. Fiona Looney is feeling your pain.
I think that that sort of adrenaline burst is part of it. You have to be exhausted going into it. You have to really have gone over the jumps for this.
Oh, no, I don't know. Like, I mean, the thought of it, just the thought of the car park. Even just the car park.
Funnily enough, the particular issue that people found most stressful, and I have to say this would probably be the same for me, is the long queues in the supermarket. Mm. So you know the way the only place for those queues to go is down the aisles. Mm-hmm. And then you've people trying to shop across the trolleys, which is it becomes like a sort of a, it's the Mount Everest of trolley dashes. You know, you've got sort of this obstacle course where people are leaning over heaped trolleys trying to get to the bottom shelf to get the soy sauce or whatever it is.
Yeah, the last soy sauce on the almost empty shelf.
And it'll always be the last one. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, so crowds, car parks, empty shelves. And then in the days before Christmas, when people do their big food shop, because obviously the retailers know that people are going to be in queues and they're going to be stressed, they put the staff into sort of, you know, like Christmas jumpers or Christmas T-shirts and Santa hats with tinsel around them and boxes of Quality Street. And you're more angry than you've ever been in your life. And you're looking at somebody like with a box of, you know, of sweets in front of you and going, this is all wrong. You know, the optics of it don't match at all.
Yeah, well, this is the problem. Well, one person has texted, Shay says, the trick is to get there early. December 23rd every year, I'll rise at 6. I'll be there for the supermarket opening at 7 a.m. You've the benefit of the quieter aisles, everything having been restocked overnight. Highly recommended, said Shay. I think I did that last year, actually. But that, the panic of it. Fiona.
And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. I'm not here next week, but we will have a playback best of on December 28th. Chat to you then.